Okay, the second case today is the United States versus Pablona. Counsel ready? Okay, we'll hear from the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Christopher McMahon. I, along with Ms. Rebecca Snyder, represent the appellant in this case, Michael Pablona. Chief Judge, if I may, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes rebuttal time.
Granted.
Your Honors, when a prosecutor presents a criminal case against an accused and brings the full weight of the government down on him, his words matter. And he can't use those words to supplement the evidence and circumvent the fact-finding process to push what he thinks is his theme of the case. And in this case, counsel did just that. He could have made the points he wanted to by zealously advocating his positions, but what he did instead was argued facts not in evidence, personally attacked the accused, mocked the defense in the role of the defense counsel, and offered substantive commentary on the evidence. Now, there was no objection to this at trial, so this court's going to review this under a plain error analysis. So,
speaking of that, counsel, I mean, where are the defense counsel in these cases? I mean, aren't they in the courtroom when all this is going on?
It's a fair point, Your Honor. These are definitely, they were objectionable statements. They should have been objected to, and they weren't.
Is it possible the defense counsel didn't think they were that egregious with respect to everything else in the case?
It is possible he thought that, Your Honor, but I'm not sure if that's relevant. Whether he thought they were or not, it doesn't change the fact that they were objectively plain error.
Well, if it's such a parade of horribles, then why are we looking at it through the lens of plain error?
I guess I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
We have cases where we've said that it may be very relevant that the defense counsel didn't think that they were that it was important enough to object.
It's relevant to the analysis, Your Honor. There's no question about that. But I just don't think it wins the day, especially when the conduct is as egregious as it is in this case.
Right, but if it's that egregious, wouldn't you have a claim of ineffective assistance before the court?
That's a possibility, Your Honor. That's not something we pursued. It's a straightforward analysis under the plain error review. Doing ineffective assistance would add another level of review, which, frankly, I guess a tactical decision on our part, I don't think is necessary for this case.
Okay.
This case can be resolved under the plain error analysis.
Okay.
So given the fact...
Counsel, before you go on, you provided a chart with the number of trial counsel statements to the members. Are we supposed to look at all of those, or do we only look at those that resulted in a guilty finding? Because there are a number of them that actually... They were talking about evidence of which he was acquitted.
That's true, Your Honor. Some of them related to particularly the obstruction of justice charge. That's a fair point, Your Honor, but I think we have to take all of them together because I don't think when the members are listening to the arguments, they can separate out necessarily the which comments go to which charge. And I think the cumulative effect of all these comments, you just can't take one out because it doesn't relate to a charge on which he was found guilty. So, Your Honors, I think given that this is a plain error review, this lends itself to using Fletcher as sort of the benchmark for comparison in this case.
Well, I want to jump straight to prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
This is a case involving a senior non-commissioned officer who is accused of a number of very serious dishonesty. He was acquitted of a fair number of the charges. He was convicted of some dishonesty offenses. He got an absolutely derisory sentence, so derisory that the government argued it was sub-jurisdictional and shouldn't even have gone here. Now, in view of all that, where's the prejudice?
Prejudice is here, Your Honor. There's no doubt about it that he was acquitted of half the charges. But that cuts both ways. As former Chief Judge Baker indicated in Hornback, in that case, the defendant was acquitted of 5 of the 8 charges. Now, as he said, it can suggest that the members found the government's case close, were open to persuasion, and sort of followed the instructions of the judge. But it also could indicate that the character evidence, the improper comments, could have made a difference.
Was that a dissent or is that in the majority?
That was a dissent, pardon me if I didn't make that clear. But I think that it's still a valid point. The character evidence may have made a difference either directly or indirectly, by giving members a margin of comfort that even if there was a doubt, appellant deserved what he got. Now,
he got very little.
Well, he got very little on sentencing, Your Honor, and I'll concede that the prejudice, that's a tough sell for that portion of it. But he didn't get little.
Sell it to me.
Well, here it goes, Your Honor. A federal conviction, now the government was very clear about this. This is a serious case. Now, this isn't just BAH fraud. This is a felony-level offense. So he's convicted of a felony-level offense on two charges. So that, although his sentence was light, that is something that's going to carry with him for the rest of his life. So my point with Judge Baker's dissent is that he thought maybe they thought that he deserved what he got, given all the bad character evidence. And I think that's just the same danger that's present in this case. They described him as a liar, that he sleeps in a bed of lies. He's a second-rate con artist. He's a pathetic excuse for a husband. He's a deadbeat. He's a manipulator. He's an idiot. So they may have thought, well, maybe he's not guilty of the conspiracy, but, you know, all these other bad characteristics go sort of push them over to a guilty. And I think that's what happened in this case. It seems that the prosecutor developed a theme. He wanted this sort of narrative of the case. And what he said was, and I think this is in his last statement, that he's a con artist, and this is his last con. So that was sort of the framework that he wanted to use.
Isn't that a fair comment on the evidence?
It's not, Your Honor. The reason is this. Now, this happened over a period of a couple of years. But the actual incident, what he did was he submitted a fraudulent request, so the government alleges, for this BAH. Now, that's one action, and he got the benefit granted for a few years. But the government's making it sound like he's this con artist, he's this scammer going around bilking all these people out of money. It says this
well,
is his
he
last...
Well, he did pay her cell phone bill.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the car insurance, maybe. But he says this is, he's a con artist, and this is the last con. Well, according to what the members would know at this point, I mean, this is an allegation of his first con. So just right there in sort of framing the case...
Wasn't that statement made in rebuttal in response to the defense's argument that the government was trying to paint him as a criminal mastermind? And he said, no, I don't think he's a criminal mastermind. I think he's an idiot.
Yes, Your Honor.
And this is he's a con artist, and this is his last con.
Yes. Well, again, all of these points that the government was trying to make here, they could have been made. They could have been made if they were with valid arguments by posing hypotheticals. Does it make sense that he's a criminal mastermind when he can't seem to get his act together? Again, just posing it as a question rather than saying he's an idiot. I mean, that talk about sort of degrading the dignity of the courtroom. I mean, to call him an idiot, a liar, a manipulator, I mean, that's just, there's no reason for that. It has no evidentiary value.
Well, I mean, you complain about them calling him a deadbeat, but I mean, isn't the definition of a deadbeat someone that doesn't provide support?
Yes, but you could pose it. It appears he is someone who does not provide support. There's no reason to color it with these derogatory terms. A deadbeat is just, it's disrespectful to the process, it's disrespectful to the accused who hasn't been convicted of anything at this point.
Isn't the question as to whether he lied or not and therefore was a liar goes to the heart of the charges?
It goes to the heart of the charges.
That's what the government was trying to prove.
The government was trying to prove that he lied on the statement saying he was entitled to the BAH. Now, that's fair. He lied here. And he lied to other people to sort of keep up what they suggested was a scam. He told people that he was married. He was sort of putting out that he had this life together. Fair argument. But you can't say he's a liar. He's guilty because he lied on these occasions, and that goes to the charge. You can't say he's guilty because he's a liar, and he lies all the time, and he sleeps in a bed of lies, which I don't think under any standard that comment could be seen as appropriate. And one thing I'd like to say on that, in terms of the plain and obvious analysis, now, this court has been very clear. Calling the accused a liar is a dangerous practice that should be avoided. Now, this court first articulated that in 1983 in Clifton. 10 years later, you once again articulated it in Fletcher. And at that point, you found error, but you didn't find that it was obvious. I think the government would be hard-pressed to argue at this point that it's not obvious, it's not plain, and it's not prejudicial to call a defendant a liar and to say that he sleeps in a bed of lies. There's no value to that statement.
Is there a different standard when we're involved with charges that involve honesty?
Yes. Well, it's a fine line, Your Honor. And Again, to say that he lied on the form is fair. To say that he lied to other people to keep up the appearance is fair. But what they're suggesting that he sleeps in a bed of lies is that you have to find him guilty because he's a liar.
No, they're suggesting he repeatedly lied, which the evidence supports.
Yes, Your Honor, it does, but it doesn't support that he sleeps in a bed of lies.
That is a metaphor.
And an appropriate metaphor, Your Honor. I mean, you can use all sorts of inappropriate metaphors, and there's no question. All of these questions, it's a fine line. It's the words.
Well, and it's a very fine line when the evidence shows he repeatedly was dishonest and he repeatedly lied.
Are you drawing a distinction between saying that for trial counsel to say he lied in this specific instance is different from saying he is an inveterate liar, he is incapable of telling the truth?
That's what I'm
is
trying
that
to
the distinction you're trying
that
to
is make? That is completely different. And I would suggest it's even more relevant in a case where lying is part of it. You have to prove that he lied, but then to say he's a liar, I mean, that just crosses the bounds and blurs the lines. So I would suggest in a case...
If he needs to be a liar in order to be guilty, why can't you say he's a liar?
He needs to lie in order to be found guilty, Your Honor. It's like saying to, in a sex assault case, he's a rapist, he's a child molester, he's a predator. There's no difference.
You don't think that you could say in a rape case he raped her?
Yes, you can say he raped her, and you can say he lied. You can't call him a rapist or a liar, Your Honor. It's a fine line, but I think it's an important distinction.
It's a particularly fine line when we're reviewing this for plain error.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would just reiterate again, this Court has been very clear that calling an accused a liar is a dangerous practice. How more clear could it be that this is error than what Fletcher said and what Clifton said before it? I'd like to spend a little time, if I may, just going back to the other errors in this case, because I think it's important for the prejudice analysis to show just the accumulation of the inappropriate conduct in this case. So, again, he sort of set the framework with he's a con artist, and this is his last con. And then he uses facts not in evidence to support that, these $500 trips to strip clubs. There is nothing in the evidence to support that, and the government indicating that it's common knowledge to someone in Italy that the Venetian is a gentleman's club, I think is not a credible argument.
Counsel, what should have happened at that point in the courtroom, in your view?
Well, ideally there should have been objection to that, Your Honor, there's no question. But it's not solely on the defense attorney to make those objections. The judge should have exercised the gatekeeper role at some point. Now, it's a fine line because these are sort of sprinkled all throughout the argument. So what's the one point that was the tipping point? That's tough to say. But at some point, the judge should have intervened. And
what do you think the judge's duty is, or if he has one?
Pardon, Your Honor?
What do you think the judge's duty is if in fact he has it?
I think the judge's duty would be when it becomes apparent that the arguments are causing a danger that the members are going to find the accused possibly guilty based on the arguments rather than the evidence, it's time for the judge to step in. And I think that's what happened in this case.
And is that an error on the part of the judge from your point of view, or whose error is that?
I think that it's both the defense attorney and the judge, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. So just... briefly concluding on the error, the plain error, the conduct portion of it, he lays the framework, he attacks his character, and then he bolsters his own narrative. And I think the most troubling statement was he invested all that time to come down here and get this guy worked up to where he'd be reliable when he spoke to NCIS. Now, he actually tells the truth, not the truth according to the accused, but the actual truth. And this is the most problematic part of that statement. He does the right thing. Now, that is just, I mean, that's probably could be used as a textbook definition of vouching for your witness. He's basically pitting us against them. We're the good guys, we're the government, we wear the white hat, we're here to tell you the truth, and our witness, he's doing the right thing. He's not trying to fool you like the defense. He's on our side.
Let's just assume that this was plain error.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in your time remaining, I'd like to hear your prejudice argument, because I think... he was charged with four charges. He was acquitted of two. The jury listened to something, paid attention to the evidence, and paid attention to the judge's instructions.
If I might, Your Honor, I think in terms of the severity analysis, the raw numbers, and the fact that there were no curative instructions, I think that pretty much speaks for itself. So I'm going to go right to the weight of the evidence, which I think is probably the heart of what this court wants to talk about. I think, again, it does cut both ways that there was a split verdict in this case, but it also suggests that there was a certain amount of doubt. Now, what I think is important, too, was the fact that after 3 hours, they came back and asked for reconsideration. So at least one of the members had some doubt or some confusion about these charges. Now, we'll never be able to get into the mind of what actually happened, but it is a good indicator. And this charge...
Is it a good indicator they were doing their job?
Well, yes. But, I mean, that's... This reconsideration instruction is often given at trial. It's rarely exercised. So I think this is significant that they actually asked for it in this case.
Counselor, can I focus a little bit more, though, on the prejudice aspect in terms of the evidence in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you'll concede there was significant circumstantial evidence, never cohabitated with the so-called wife, took leave 18 times, never visited her. But I'd like to focus on one particular thing because I want to make sure I properly understand it. So I'd like you to correct me if my understanding is mistaken.
Yes, Your Honor.
Wasn't one of the witnesses a friend of the accused, a reluctant witness, and didn't he say that the accused confided in him that, in fact, the accused had married her for the BAH?
He did, Your Honor. And if I may...
So why isn't that particularly damaging in the prejudice context?
Well, it's certainly not helpful evidence for him. There's no doubt about that. But this case, I mean, that might sound strong, but it's not necessarily illegal to get married for BAH. People do it all the time. They may speed up their wedding. It just makes sense to do it. So we don't know the rest of the context, maybe, of that conversation. And the question that this case centers on, the heart of it, is getting into the intent at the time that they were married. Now, on the face of it, it seems like that's an easy question, but I'll submit to this court that it's not, because his wife didn't testify, so we don't know what her viewpoint was. He never made a confession. So what the government is left with, and, Your Honor, I see that my time is running short. May I conclude?
You can finish this question.
So what they're left with is circumstantial evidence of his intent at the time he got married. And this evidence that the government submitted certainly could support a theory that this was a sham marriage. But it also could support a theory that perhaps he wasn't a good husband, or that they just didn't prove the case. Now, there's evidence from his wife that said, yes, we married for love. And I believe he indicated that during the investigation as well. And he did say to his friend, yes, we married for BAH, but that may have been a host of reasons why they got married. So there's no question that the evidence does support that theory, but it also could support an alternative theory or no theory at all, just that the government didn't prove the case. And I think the danger that happened in this case was that these prejudicial arguments, this con artist who's conducting all these cons all over this place, this liar, this manipulator, that sort of inflammatory rhetoric pushed the members over to a finding of guilty in this case. And there's no certainty to that. But I think the standard is if there's a danger that the members found him guilty not based solely on the evidence alone. And if there's ever a case where that is a possibility, I would suggest this would be the one. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from the government.
Morning, Chief Judge Erdman, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Lieutenant James Belforti, and along with Colonel Valerie Danielek, I represent the United States. Appellant has not established that any of the trial counsel's comments were plain error, but even if he had, there's no prejudice in this case because the appellant was acquitted of 50% of the charges of which he faced and he received a relatively light sentence that included no punitive discharge. Now, this demonstrates that the members followed the instructions of the military judge and that he received a fair trial, which is the ultimate touchstone in a case of alleged prosecutorial misconduct.
Counsel, you're just saying that there was no plain error, no prejudice. In your brief, you said, when considering trial counsel's comments in context and light of the evidence presented at trial, there was no prosecutorial misconduct, which is different from saying no plain error, no prejudice.
Yeah.
So it's your position that none of these statements constitute prosecutorial misconduct?
Your Honor, there are so many allegations here, and I want to try to put these into certain categories to try to assist the Court. So a couple of these I think the Court can deal with pretty easily, and those go to charges of which the appellant was acquitted. So, for example, statements about Yadira, his wife, she's full of it, she tells ridiculous stories, that doesn't sound cooperative to me. Those all go to charges about the conspiracy. He was acquitted of that. So even assuming that those are plain error for argument's sake, which they aren't necessarily, there's no prejudice there. And the same thing with some of the statements that go to the obstruction charge. That's rubbish on Joint Appendix 111, inescapably clear on 112. It's clear what he's up to on 140. It's clear that he intended to impede the investigation. That's on 143. He's a manipulator and a user. Those all go to the obstruction of justice charge. So all of those comments aren't relevant to the findings, except in the sense that they demonstrate what this court already presumes, which is that the members follow the instructions of the military judge. And not only do we have that presumption here, and nothing to overcome that presumption from the appellant, but the record bears that out, which is they listened to some of the arguments of the trial counsel, and they listened to the evidence, and they found some convincing beyond a reasonable doubt, and some they didn't. So I think the court can deal with those pretty quickly. Now, there's a number of...
You're saying, though, that we assume, which is, of course, the case, that panel members listened to the instructions. Was there a curative instruction here?
There aren't curative instructions because there was no objection here, but there were, I want to make 2 points. There were standard instructions about the arguments of counsel not being evidence, and the trial counsel himself in rebuttal on 140 of the joint appendix says, now these are commentaries on the evidence, not evidence itself. So in the same breath that he's supposedly saying these things that are so overwhelming to the members that he cannot get a fair trial, he's reminding the members of their duty and the instruction of the military judge. So the appellant can't have it both ways. He can't say, well, they're taking everything the trial counsel says as absolute gospel, and then say, yeah, but they didn't pay attention to those instructions, and they didn't pay attention to the echoing of those instructions.
Well, counsel, you're not suggesting that that gives the trial counsel license, are you?
No, Your Honor.
Just because after committing, not necessarily in this case, but in a given case, a list of horribles during the argument, and concluding it with, oh, that's okay, members, that's me talking, you're not suggesting that that gives him a license to say whatever he wants to leading up to that point.
No, Your Honor, I was answering a question about curative measures. So I think that's something that should be considered. And because this is a plain error case, by definition, there isn't going to be an objection and then an instruction from the military judge. But just because it's plain, that shouldn't make the standard less strong. If anything, it should make it stronger, harder for the appellant to overcome, because there could have been strategic reasons not to object. And there's something that, I think it's on page 130 of the joint appendix. The trial defense counsel says in his closing, well, if the fact that he's a private person, if that's so absurd, that came from HM1 Partita Jacobo, and he's their best witness. So he's kind of using the trial counsel's words as a weapon against him, which gives us a little bit of a view into what was going on in the case here.
Counselor, here's a question, which is, I mean, what are we to do, right? There certainly are, I don't agree with the appellant that all of these comments are objectionable, all right, but there's certainly some that, like, maybe it's not plain error, but they didn't need to come out of trial counsel's mouth, right?
Sure.
You're not going to disagree with that, are you?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, and this is the second case on this same issue today, and what are we to do? I mean, trial counsel seem unable to rein themselves in to give appropriate argument, which I understand. I was trial counsel, and I made stupid arguments, too. But it needs to stop.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the court's job is to evaluate legal errors and determine whether or not those legal errors were prejudicial. And the fact that we're at this point and we're here in front of this court, I think that's a pretty good that has the nice deterrent effect of keeping prosecutors from making such arguments in the future. So
I don't know. I think that's what Judge Ryan is getting at, is that we see any number of these cases, and this court has opined on what is and is not proper in the government counsel's argument, but we continue to get the case. So I think her concern is that, hey, look, is anybody reading our cases? I mean, they may not be, but. But that's the question, isn't it?
I mean, I'm not suggesting that, you know, that you have to be, you know, the red-haired stepchild of the cumulative errors of those who have gone before you. But, I mean, we need some adult supervision of these problems.
It's true, Your Honor, but, again, that's this court's role is to rule on legal error and to determine whether or not it's prejudicial.
I don't disagree with that.
But counsel, despite your concessions to Judge Ryan that some of these comments may have been inappropriate, the overall tenor of the government's case is that everything was fine. This was just, there was no problem here at all. These were all appropriate comments. There was no opinion given. And it's that kind of a response to us that makes us wonder about how seriously the government is taking our cases that say some of these things are not permissible.
Well, Your Honor, speaking for myself, I'm certainly taking it very seriously. But in regards to, I think my friend, the appellate defense counsel, makes a good point about certain things, which is it's a fine line. A lot of these are a fine line. And a lot of the comments that he's talking about seems to be, well, he didn't need to say that he's a liar. He could have just said he lied. Or he didn't need to say that he's a deadbeat. That was, you know, impolite. And the very fact that it's a fine line demonstrates that it's not plain error. If it's arguable on both sides, it's not plain error. And we're getting close to, I think my friend's argument is taking us down the path towards a magic words test.
Let me ask you the question. Is it still the government's position that none of the statements went up to the level of plain error?
Yes, none of the statements went up to the level of plain error. What I would say is there are some that are probably a little bit more problematic than others.
What about the schizophrenia comment?
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, you know, schizophrenia, in addition to being a mental health diagnosis, also has a secondary definition in the dictionary about, you know, contradictory or adverse thinking.
You think the panel was aware of the secondary definition in the dictionary?
I think they were, Your Honor. I think saying that it's something...
The whole thing, you know, they're friendly people and they fine line and see it in criminals. I mean, that you're not going to convince me that that was an appropriate statement.
Well, Your Honor, what I'd say is when we look at the context of what he's saying is he's responding to evidence or at least a suggestion that the appellant might have PTSD. He's basically saying, no, he doesn't have PTSD. There's no evidence that he has PTSD, but there is this other thing called schizophrenia and it makes people two-faced and all these other things. Now, definitely on the borderline at best, but what it shows is he's not actually arguing that this man has a mental health diagnosis. That wouldn't make any sense. He's responding that because the appellant is suggesting, well, he has PTSD, and that makes him less morally blameworthy for this, so he should get a lighter sentence. This is on sentencing, Your Honor. So so in that context, we see he's not saying, no, he doesn't have PTSD. He has this far more serious mental health diagnosis that makes him even less morally blameworthy for this. By the context, what he's saying is he's two-faced. He's duplicitous. Again, I agree with you, Your Honor, that it's definitely borderline. But, again, it's on sentencing. And when we look at it from a prejudice standpoint, he got basically a slap on the wrist.
What was the total value of the BAH fraud?
It was approximately $45,000, Your Honor. And that's another thing I'd like to, since we're talking about sentencing and the prejudice on that end, when we look at what the trial counsel asked for in sentencing and what the defense counsel asked for in sentencing, that's probably reveals a lot about the prejudice in this case. Because the trial counsel asked for 5 years of confinement and a dishonorable discharge and a $100,000 fine. Trial defense counsel asked for a period of restriction and reduction. And obviously no punitive discharge. And that's what he basically got here. He got 60 days of confinement, he got 60 days of restriction, he got no punitive discharge, and then he got a $60,000 fine. And the trial defense counsel conceded that he would have to pay the money back. So if anything, they split the baby in this case. If they leaned more towards the defense in terms of the sentence. And in that way...
And I just don't know the answer to this. Does the fine go towards repaying the funds?
I don't think so. Seems Judge Suki's saying I'm going to agree with
that. It goes to the Treasury.
This was kind of a complicated part of this case that's not really related to these proceedings. But in actuality, based on what happened after the case, he only ended up paying about $29,000 of the fine.
Did the $29,000 come out of his forfeitures?
No, that I believe that came from him paying it. He coughed it up, and then there was an indigency.
Okay, because he's also subject to forfeitures.
Yes, Your Honor. So, and I agree that that's kind of a more complicated in the weeds part of the case.
Yeah, don't go there.
Yeah, I won't, Your Honor. I want to respond to something that my friend said earlier about.
Can I get back to one point that you made already, though? You were talking about with the improper comments that they went to the offenses where the accused was acquitted.
Yes, sir.
Can we really parse it that way when trial counsel is referring to not the fact that he lied in this instance, but called him a liar and said that he sleeps in a bed of lies? Can we then say there is some type of wall between that statement and being focused on the offenses for which he was acquitted as compared to the fact that he was convicted on other charges?
Well, I agree with Your Honor that the comment, he's a liar and he sleeps in a bed of lies, it goes to the entirety of the charges. So I'm not saying that that's not problematic because he was acquitted of certain charges. I mean, in terms of the prejudice, it is. But I was saying that there were specific comments that were targeted. When you read them in context, he's saying, I want to turn to the obstruction of justice charge. Or he's talking specifically about Yadira and Nahemi and saying, she's full of it, she's unbelievable. Her credibility is only relevant in the conspiracy charge, and that's evident from the findings here. Because if they find her to be credible and they believe her that she was duped or whatever, it doesn't matter in terms of the false official statement or the larceny charge. It only matters on the conspiracy charge. So what I was saying was there are certain comments, when you look at them in context, it's clear that he's pointing towards specific charges. Now, some of them are kind of straddle both. I'd say those need to be looked at more carefully. Like, for example, the liar and he sleeps in a bed of lies. But I just want to make one point on that, the liar sleeps in a bed of lies. My friend pointed out that in this court in Fletcher said that is error, but it wasn't plain or obvious. And I think that carries the day here, because in Fletcher, that's a case about drug usage, where the appellant actually testified. So that's far more dangerous in that case, where he's saying, this guy's a liar, he's a liar, he's a liar, as opposed to in this case where the government has to demonstrate dishonesty in all of the charges. So as you pointed out, Judge Ryan, I mean, saying someone's a liar in a case that's about lying, maybe not appropriate discourse, but certainly not plain error. And if it wasn't plain error in the context of Fletcher, it can't be plain error in a context where dishonesty is before us. And that's something that this court has said as consistently from back in 1956, with the United States v. Doctor, that calling someone a liar in a case about false swearing or a related case, that's not error.
Counsel, in the prejudice analysis context, does it give you pause that the CCA referred to the government's evidence here as only, quote, reasonably strong? End quote.
That doesn't give me pause, Your Honor. I think that the evidence speaks for itself. And again, the evidence we're looking at is the strength of the charges of which he was convicted. He never lived with his wife. He had told his best friend that I got married for the BAH. And, you know, my friend's comments on that, well, it was taken out of context. I mean, yeah, we have to look at things in context. That's important for this case. But That's parsing language. I mean, that's very strong evidence. He also had never visited his wife. He wasn't providing her with any support. Their stories didn't line up in any way. Some of the things he said, for example, oh, I support her by paying for her car insurance when she doesn't have a driver's license, that is pretty flimsy. That is not credible. And to call it such, say it's ridiculous or absurd, I mean, that may be rhetorical flourish, but that's not prosecutorial misconduct. That's the trial counsel's he's not just able to do that. He has a duty to strike hard blows on behalf of the government. And one of the things that my friends talk about in terms of the strength of the government's case is, well, it's all circumstantial evidence. Well, of course, because it goes to his intent when he got married. We can't have direct evidence of his intent unless he gets up on the stand and says, at the time I did this, I intended to defraud the United States. And obviously we don't have that here. So being able to argue, hey, this is what one commonly sees in a marriage. People tend to live together. People tend to communicate a little bit. In the context of this case, it's important that the trial counsel be able to argue those things. Otherwise, the United States is going to be handcuffed. So, again, I agree that there are certain comments here that are borderline or maybe, you know, have exceeded the bounds of decorum in the court, but certainly not plain error. And even if they were, they're not prejudicial. I want to make one more point before I conclude. In my friend's argument, he talked about how the number of issues can impact this court. This court's never held that a bunch of non-errors can be aggregated together to constitute an error. It might become appropriate to consider on a prejudice analysis, but we don't look at a bunch of things that are short of error and then say, well, they're not really errors, but they're a little over the line, so we'll bunch them together and then we'll say that's over the line. This court's never held that. And I think this case, being a plain error case, it's an improper vehicle to announce that for the first time. So to conclude, if there are no further questions, Fletcher is not a magic words test. There's nothing that specifically just triggers prosecutorial misconduct out of the blue. It's a contextual analysis looking for a violation of a legal norm and prejudice. Even if there was some violation of legal norm here, and even if it was plain or obvious, the results of this case buttress the presumption this court already has, which is that the members followed the instructions of the military judge and that the appellant received a fair trial. And that's the ultimate benchmark in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
I'd like to respond, Your Honors, to one thing counsel just said. He said that this court has never held that the sort of cumulative effect carries the day. Well, I would counter that by saying it's part of the test, the severity analysis, which is the first part, and the first question of the first part, which is the raw numbers. How many times this happened? And the second part of the analysis is, was it confined to one particular part of the argument, or was it spread throughout the whole?
I think he was arguing that if it wasn't an error to begin with, you can't accumulate things that aren't error and make it an error.
That's what he was saying.
Okay. Well, I'll still make the point about the severity portion of it. Again, the amount in this case, I think, is compelling. One other thing I'd like to address, because I might not have made it clear, in terms of the lying aspect, because I think that's important here, saying that he lies, again, is perfectly acceptable, but calling him a liar is tantamount to saying he's a bad guy. It's tantamount to saying it's a different way of saying he's a deadbeat, he's a manipulator, he's a loser. These are all ways of saying that this is not a savory character. So I think in that regard, that's why it's problematic in this case. And I just want to reiterate, too, this case, I think the lower court had it right. It's reasonably strong. You could have the theory, but there are problems with it because counsel said that you couldn't have direct evidence. Well, sure you could. You could have his wife come to testify that they made this arrangement. They didn't have that. All they had from her was that, yes, we did marry for love, and he paid my car insurance. So there could have been direct evidence, and there wasn't. Now, one comment I'd just like to address with you, which I didn't touch on before, which I think is just, it really goes to the heart of this case. When they're talking about the defense arguments, he says if defense counsel gets up here, lights his hair on fire, juggles on a unicycle, does or says any number of things that have nothing to do with this case, remember, you have the facts to support this. I think that's probably one of the most egregious comments here. Now, on the face of it, it seems sort of like a lighthearted comment, but when you really drill down on what he's saying, I mean, he's mocking the role of the defense counsel. He's saying...
You don't think that that's a fair comment on argument?
No, Your Honor. I think you can say the things that may be said may confuse the issue. There may be things that you should perhaps disregard. But to say you're a clown on a unicycle with your hair on fire, I mean, I can picture it when he's saying it. It's a ridiculous image.
I'm a clown.
He inferred it, I would suggest, Your Honor. And I would just like to conclude. I see my time is running short. May I briefly conclude? The deterrent aspect of this. Now, I would say that the government's brief did do a good job, admittedly, of demonstrating what the proper arguments in this case could have been. They addressed them each very systematically and imposed them in a way which wouldn't have been problematic. But that's not the way they were said. Now, trial counsel harped on the fact that this was a felony-level offense and that the stakes were high, and of course that's true. And when the stakes are this high, counsel is responsible for everything that comes out of his mouth. So just as words mean something, these rules should mean something. And that's why, Chief Pablona, respectfully request that you set aside this conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted. and the court is adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise.